everybody, it's Michael Steele here. Now, I know you're waiting for the next big episode of the Michael Steele Podcast, but in the meantime, give a listen to this Michael Steele Podcast quick take.
We're talking with my buddy Nick Troiano. Nick, as I had mentioned to you earlier in the beginning, is doing some great work in the voting space. He's the executive director of Unite America and of the Unite America Foundation Institute, rather. So, Nick, one quick question before I get into some of the politics of voting. Have you guys looked at the national popular vote at all? Because you talked about, wouldn't it be great in the next 10 years to have these kind of reforms? I've talked about this. I've been involved with national popular vote for a number of years now. And, you know, folks who listen to this podcast, you've heard me kind of preach about it and what it does to sort of open up the process at the presidential level to allow for the direct election of the president through the Electoral College and the voting process there by allowing states to agree to enter into a compact where they commit their Electoral College votes to the winner of the national popular vote. And we're about 92, I believe, 92, 96, somewhere in there, Electoral College votes away from implementing that in a presidential election, which our hope will be 2024. Imagine a 2024 election cycle in which candidates now have to campaign in all 50 states, mm-hmm. as opposed to the 12 battleground states. Imagine candidates having to build up towards their national popular vote, meaning a Republican is going to spend a lot of time in California to turn out the 5 million voters who don't go to the polls after 5 o'clock. Because why bother? They just called the election on the East Coast. And Democratic candidates spending a lot of time in the South to build up their numbers in those areas. Very much in part what we saw Stacey Abrams do in turning the vote around in a state like Georgia in 2020, building up those numbers. What's your thinking on aspects like that, complementary to the overarching idea? I mean, one more example of what can be done in this space?
Well, I think when our government is doing such a poor job delivering on results, it's a good time to be thinking about all kinds of reforms that might change the incentive structure of our politics.
Right.
America is more focused on reforms that can garner bipartisan support and would have a nonpartisan impact. So we focus on vote at home and independent redistricting, ranked choice voting, primary reform. And one of the ways that that intersects with the presidential election is in advocating for the use of ranked choice voting, especially in the presidential primaries. And that's because we should want a candidate to emerge from that process that can get broad support and majority support from the party, not someone in a multi-candidate race that would just get support from the largest faction and potentially be more extreme. And that's honestly what we saw in 2016 when President Trump won the primary, but he didn't win a majority of Republican primary voters.
Right.
And so in 2020, the Democratic Party used ranked choice voting in about 5 states. Republicans may be looking into it for 2024 because some states on the Republican side are actually using ranked choice voting to in their nominating processes, including in Virginia for their upcoming.
Right. No, that in Virginia.
Yeah.
How does we've got the politics of voting, which we're now seeing played out in states like Georgia and Arizona, Pennsylvania, where legislators are. I think disincentivizing voters to participate by making it harder. There are some who would dispute that. Okay, let's have that debate. But I'm sorry, when you only have one drop box in a state for people to take their ballots, I think I'm not driving, 7 hours to go drop off a ballot, right? You know, so that's an extreme example, but. A really good one in the sense of how people are sort of perceiving what's going on here. What's your take on some of these initiatives and how they may potentially impact the 22 cycle?
Well, I think that both parties probably exaggerate the impact that the other party's agenda may have on the electorate, meaning that Democrats really over-index on, say, how a voter ID requirement may depress the vote, or Republicans over-index on the idea of thinking actually making it easier to vote will bring more Democrats to the polls. The data doesn't really show either of these things to be true. And in fact, in 2020, with a dramatic increase in vote by mail, the data shows not only did mail voting wasn't itself responsible for larger turnout, it didn't really have a partisan impact in itself. So a lot of these issues carry with it a lot of politics, but not grounded in a lot of reality. What we should instead do, I hope, is both parties just focus on how to make a secure but accessible voting experience for all voters, and then worry about turning out your voters and actually campaigning on ideas. The silver lining, I think, that we've seen of late is that it's possible to do. In Kentucky, you had Democrats and Republicans come together to pass bipartisan legislation to make permanent some of the temporary adjustments to the voting system from 2020, which increased security and increased access. That's the nexus, I think, of where the focus should be. But instead, this issue, like others, has just become, you know, too polarized, too partisan, and it's not about evidence-based policymaking.
It's gotten caught up in this whole right, progressive, left, conservative narrative. And so when you look at, for example, you know, you're an independent, I'm a Republican, you've got, you know, certainly in my party, the pressure now of sort of, you know, the Freedom Caucus types, which are now Trumpified to, you know, a certain space. And you've got most recently, they're now going from the Freedom Caucus to the America Caucus, in which they will promote Anglo-Saxon values. I don't know what the hell that is. and I don't know how you put that on a ballot, but what's happening in our politics now, particularly in the right/conservative space, where it is much more nationalistic, much more fascist in its views, very much anti-immigrant, anti-other. How does that impact when you see, I mean, voters, largely speaking, but then how does it impact those voters who we know demographically are going to be key players in future elections? Meaning, as more Black and Hispanics decide to participate in the process, which they clearly are, just by the numbers. I mean, Hispanics are, what, 60,000 plus Hispanics turning 18 years old every month in this country. So the math is not working if you have that kind of view that's being adopted by many on the conservative right. How does that play out politically?
Well, I would just say that some of the most extreme elements that get a lot of airtime in our politics just isn't representative of where either party or especially where the country is at today. Again, it's representative.
Yeah, but they're driving it. They're driving the story, though.
Right. And the reason why is, again, going back to this primary problem, those are the voters that are actually determining the outcomes. Let's give an example.
So they're holding that over their heads like a sword of Damocles, right?
Right. Marjorie Taylor Greene. How much time have we spent talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Way too much.
She won less than half of the vote in her primary, but only 8% of eligible voters in her district actually supported her in the primary. So you have 8% of Georgians that voted for Marjorie Taylor Greene in the primary. Madison Cawthorn, 5% of his district of eligible voters wound up supporting him in his primary. Lauren Boebert, 19%. And so you realize that some of the most extreme elements, even of the Republican Party, are a product of some of the most extreme voters. Those voters ought to have a say, but just not a disproportionate say. Mm-hmm. in our politics. And the same thing can be seen on the left, although the type of extremism is different. It's more ideological on the left than it is anti-truth or anti-democracy. But in 2018, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was elected, she won with only 5% of eligible voters in her district in the primary. And so the tail is wagging the dog in our politics. If we had a more representative system of elections, we wouldn't be getting such, I think, extreme outcomes.
So what do we do, Nick, to get there? Is it education? Is it more scary moments like threats to the ballot box that we saw in 2020? I mean, you don't want people to react and respond out of fear. You want them to react and respond out of patriotism, out of civic conviction. So what do we do? How do we combat spates of anti-voter laws that are out there, but at the same time, not fall prey to this cycle of fear and demagoguery?
Yeah, my sense is that if we channeled all of the energy that we spend fighting each other and instead focus that on fixing the system, it'd be remarkable about how much change we can make.
Right. Right.
How soon?
Thanks for downloading this Michael Steele podcast quick take. Now, you can always find us on Apple Podcasts where, guess what? You can review us. You can give us 5 stars. Oh, yeah. I love the 5-star rating. Or you can catch us on iHeart, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you soon.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.